probably all of us have said it at one time or another. I'm hungry. Or maybe even gone to the superlative and said, I'm starved. Although the truth of it is that technically, very few of us have ever experienced genuine hunger, much less starvation. For men have been known to kill in order to get food. There are records in history of women who have murdered and eaten their own babies in face of starvation. And thirst? Thirst can be worse. I'm told that it is a terrible way to die. Oh, I suppose that, you know, we have all experienced a dry mouth and a parched throat at one time or another. But genuine thirst is something far more than the mouth and the throat. It involves the whole body, what physiologists call the internal environment, where it starts to do damage and even destruction to the cells of the body, where salt levels increase and the body fights to retain liquid. So persons don't perspire or urinate in order to maintain the liquid levels of their bodies. Then there is, in rapidly advancing, dehydration, a growing pain that actually can rack the entire human body. I've never experienced it, but there was a time a few years back when I thought that I might. It's about a half a dozen years ago when five of us were traveling across West Africa, and we were in the Sub-Sahara where it was terribly hot, 130 degrees in the shade, and we were careful to drink appropriate amounts of water, much like soldiers are doing now in the Saudi desert. We would have a liter of water every few hours. We would buy it by the case, in some places, even in cities, having to pay as much as $5 per liter. We were careful to make sure that we had the right supply. But it was on May 1st of that year, May Day is celebrated much more in other countries than it is here in the United States, that we found very few crossing guards as we moved into the 50-mile no-man's land between Burkina Faso and Mali and route to the Dogon of Mali. It was while we were in that in-between area on a holiday that the Toyota Land Cruiser that we were driving broke down. And in our group of five, there was an archaeologist, a man who had had a lot of experience in the Middle Eastern deserts. He quickly took charge. He quickly made it plain how we would store and how we would ration the water that we had. It was obvious that his far greater priority was watching out for the water and avoiding thirst, and not primarily getting that vehicle running again. You see, when a person is hungry enough, thirsty enough, it becomes the driving force of life. More important than just about anything else. You can take a hungry man somewhere and offer to him the gift of a 1991 Porsche, and he'll turn it down because he'd rather have a loaf of bread. So the things that we might consider to be very valuable and important, and the kind of things that we would like to have for someone who is hungry and thirsty, it's unimportant at best. It was with this sense of the power of hunger and thirst, in a time and a place when hunger and thirst were much more common than any of us know, that Jesus described the Christian as a citizen of heaven, saying, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled." Now, some say that this may be the most important point that Jesus made in the Sermon on the Mount, counted to be the greatest sermon ever preached anywhere by anyone. Without a doubt, these 14 words, if rightly heard and correctly understood, are powerful enough to change our lives. They are the fourth beatitude, the fourth of the blessings that Jesus spoke. And in this fourth beatitude are listed four transforming truths for us to consider this morning. The first of those transforming truths is that the way to happiness is via righteousness. The way I figure it, just about everyone anywhere wants to be happy. It is the one thing upon which everyone can agree. So So you can be rich or poor or young or old or male or female. You can be George Bush or Saddam Hussein. And happiness is what everyone is after. And everybody tries it his or her own way, or at least what others say is the best way. We try with things like money or sex or fame or power or getting the right kind of job or the appropriate title that other people call us by, or through marriage or children or love or counseling or buying a book or going on a trip. I mean, the list is just about endless of all the different ways that we try to find happiness. And it's because we think that those things lead to happiness that we value them in life. Obviously, if we knew that money would make us miserable, money would not be a high priority in the world's exchanges. February 14th is Valentine's Day, coming up this next week. It's a big day because love is considered to be a major contributor to our happiness. And if we don't have love on the 14th of February, we feel the pain of it. And if we do, we think that that is where happiness is to be found, because everybody wants to be happy. I mean, don't you? Everyone does. Well, Jesus, loving us and being greatly concerned about our needs, wanted us to be happy. In fact, that's what blessed means. That's what the Beatitudes are all about, happiness. But there is a non-secret here that most people don't know. In fact, even when most people hear it, they ignore it. Powerful, but they just sort of skip over it. It's the powerful non-secret that you'll never become happy by going after happiness. And the crazy thing is that most people know that, and yet we keep pursuing happiness in much the same way, devoting our lives to escaping pain on the one side and discovering happiness on the other side. That's why we take drugs, that's why we read books, that's why we move in and out of relationships, and yet often knowing from the very beginning that happiness is not to be found through these means. Jesus explains to us here that happiness is really a byproduct. That if you go right for happiness, you'll miss it every time. But if you go the right way, you'll get happiness on the side. Last year, Charlene and I were in conversation with a man in his mid-80s, who was a relative on her side of the family. And we had seen him about a year before, and he still had a chronic cough that he had had back the last time we had seen him. And we asked him about it, and he explained that he had tried various home remedies and things to take care of that cough. And then Charlene, made what seemed like a really earth-shaking recommendation, and that is that he go to a doctor and maybe see what was the matter. We're beginning to be concerned that there was something really seriously wrong with him. He had some interesting reasons not to go. Number one, he didn't have a doctor. As we explored this a little farther, I began to come to the conclusion he had never had a doctor. He has only been to a physician a handful of times in his entire 83 plus years. But then, in what was only an aside, I think we really got to the heart of the matter, and that is, he didn't want a shot. Now, we can identify with that, but what most of us can't identify with is, in more than 83 years, he has never had a shot. Now, that's beyond me. I mean, having grown up at least with the doctor our family had, I mean, why didn't he could have had one of mine? I mean, but he's never had a shot in his life, and he figures, you know, when he's hitting his mid-80s, it's not time to start some nonsense that he hasn't needed this far. And it took quite a bit of persuasion. Finally, he did go. Took somebody else's appointment, and the diagnosis was a chronic infection. I think it was related to his ear, that was easily treated with an oral medication, so he didn't have to have his shot. And the continuing cough was only a side effect. And so when he took care of what was really the matter, what was concerning him and everybody else around him was taken care of automatically, and now he's okay. Now, I think he's a lot like people who are looking for happiness. We think that we can find it ourselves. We open up the linen closets and the medicine cabinets of our lives, and we take off the shelves all of the home remedies so that we can get happy, because everybody's looking for that. And we're reluctant to go to the divine physician who has for us a prescription that is not a painful prescription. When we finally go, we discover that the real issue of life is righteousness and not happiness. That happiness is a side effect of righteousness. And when you are righteous, then you get the happiness that everybody is looking for. Or to put it more directly, the only way that anyone will ever get real happiness is by way of righteousness. As Jesus said, blessed, happy are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Now, for such an important term, righteousness really isn't a part of very many people's vocabularies, so we need to be sure that we understand what the word means if it is that all important. I suppose in simplest definition, to be righteous is to be right with God. It means both being right and doing right. Now, I think we know what it means to be right. I know if I have a right relationship with someone else, and I know when I don't. I know if I've offended someone. I know if there's something between us. You can just sense it. Even if sometimes you can't remember what it is, you just sense that there's a barrier there. And so we often say in our own relationships with one another, we need to make things right. Sometimes that takes an apology. Sometimes that takes some time together. Sometimes that means paying a bill that's overdue. Whatever it takes to make the relationship right so that we can be right in our relationship with one another. The same thing is true of God. Righteousness is being right with God. It is doing whatever needs to be done to remove the barriers and to have a right and proper relationship with Him. But it also means doing right. And again, that's part of our everyday conversation. We often talk about doing the right thing. For example, we say, what you need to do in business is you need to treat people right. Or we know that it's telling the truth when you could maybe easily tell a lie. Or it's keeping our word. Or it's not stealing something that could be stolen. Or it's keeping a marriage vow, perhaps under circumstances where it's difficult to keep a marriage vow. It's being generous instead of being greedy. It's doing the right thing. But most of all, in terms of God, it is doing right by Him. So it's keeping God's rules. That's what righteousness is on the doing side. It's doing things God's way. It's being like Jesus. And Jesus is here teaching us that the only way that we can be happy and blessed is to be righteous by being right and by doing right. Now, we can either take Jesus' very wise words and very quickly get to happiness, or we can do what millions of other people have done and continue to do, and that is try all of the home prescriptions that will not work for a lifetime, even when we probably know in advance they won't work, searching after this lifetime quest for happiness. Jesus says, happy are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Now, there are very few things that drive a man or a woman like really being hungry or thirsty. In fact, those who are really hungry and thirsty will do just about anything. A man will walk 100 miles in order to get water. A woman will sell her most precious possession in order to get food if she's starving. History is full of records of countries that have gone to war for water, or cities that have surrendered to a ruthless enemy in order to get food. Jesus says that God specially loves and blesses Christians who are that hungry, who are that thirsty for righteousness. Now, I got to tell you that I think that we live in a very strange chapter of history in which people have very strong individual opinions about a wide variety of causes. In fact, I think that's one of the reasons that we become so polarized in Congress or in business or in community or in families. Every day on television, you can see or hear about people who will do just about anything for whatever is their thing. So people will do just about anything for money, or for drugs, or for sex, or for politics. Some people will do just about anything for war. Other people will do just about anything for peace. We have a whole cadre of people who will do just about anything for abortion, and a whole cadre of people who will do just about anything to stop abortion. We have all kinds of people that want more taxes, and all kinds of other people whose only issue is that there not be any more taxes. The question is, who is that driven for righteousness? Who would do anything to be righteous? I mean, as much or more driven than someone is for money or for sex or for or against abortion or taxes or any of the other long list of the causes of people. I mean, who wakes up in the morning thirsty for God? Who has the rumble, not of the stomach, but the rumble of the soul throughout the day in a hunger and a thirst for the righteousness of God? Who is willing to pay any price in order to get this extraordinarily, eternally precious commodity of being right and doing right in relation to God? Who? The Christian. That's exactly what a Christian is. The disciple of Jesus Christ. The blessed. The happy person. Righteousness and God's kingdom and Jesus Christ are the driving motivations of someone who is a Christian. We as Christians really believe what Jesus says. We think he's true. He's right. We believe what he says in Matthew 6:33 when he tells us to seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and then all these other things that everybody is so bent on will be added as well. Now, in our lives, when we try to focus our attention on that which Jesus says is the way to happiness, to righteousness, we've got all these distractions, 10,000 of them, every day, everywhere, as if the enemy Satan had programmed them around us, and they're blaring out their signals, they're flashing their lights constantly, trying to take us to this side or that side, sometimes to good sides, but not to righteousness. Don't believe them. Don't look. Don't listen. You see, like the thirsty woman running for water or the hungry man who begs for food, the Christian lives for righteousness. And I'll tell you, the opportunities abound. Every one of us. I mean, where do you go? You go to school, you go to work, get together with a family, or you're together in a marriage. You're in the tough times or you're in the easy times. In all of those times, there are sub-times, 1,000 of them. When every single day we choose between righteousness and unrighteousness, we make the choice constantly. There are opportunities abounding everywhere. And it is the Christian who is hungry and thirsty to choose what is right by God's rule every single time. As Jesus said, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. That is the fourth powerful truth in this fourth beatitude. They will be filled. That only Jesus satisfies. Here in Minnesota, we have become very familiar with self-service gas stations, so much so that a quick survey here would probably reveal that very few of us, ever go to a service station where someone actually gets out of their cubby hole or building and pumps the gas into our cars. But did you know that there are two states in this country where self-service gas stations are illegal? One on the West Coast and one on the East Coast. Oregon in the West, New Jersey in the East. One time we were on a trip in Oregon and we were near a state border. It was probably the Washington border there. And we were parked in some way, I don't recall, waiting for somebody or by a restaurant or something. And I was watching this gas station as people with out-of-state plates pulled into the station. And many of them, just with routine, would get out of the car, walk over to the gas pump, pick up the handle, turn on the switch, and move over to start to fill the tank. And the service station attendant would come out somewhat like a driver of a Brinks truck, thinking that here some great crime had been committed and would cite some ordinance or state statute or something like that and threaten to call the FBI and all these horrible things because they were going to pump their own gas. And then this sheepish driver, I mean, not just one, a whole series of them, would sort of get back in the car and sit there and fidgeting with the steering wheel, not knowing what to do with their hands during this crisis, and waiting while this person then fills the tank. This is especially true with younger people who don't remember those days when there were full service stations and they checked your oil and washed your windows. They really used to do those kinds of things at some service stations. Well, it's an interesting experience to watch all of this and to see the way some people are actually stunned because they've never seen anything like it and they don't really know how it works because they've always pumped their own gas. Well, let me tell you that God has no self-righteousness stations, that we cannot pump our own. God will not allow it. It's absolutely against the rules. That the only righteousness that we can ever have, he has got to pump into us. It is his only way. It is his righteousness, and he does the filling. So again, quote Jesus, this time from John 6:35. He said, "I am the bread of life. He who comes to me will never go hungry, and he who believes in me will never be thirsty." Now get this. It is not our responsibility to get our own self-righteousness. It is our responsibility as Christians to be hungry and thirsty for that righteousness. So I ask you, what I know is kind of a personal question. Are you? Are you thirsty? Hungry? For righteousness? I mean, more than anything else in life, do you want to be right? Are you like starved for God? I mean, thirsty for Jesus Christ? Is righteousness more important to you than anything else that there is? It is the driving obsession of life. If yes, then come to God and he will fill you to the brim with Jesus. You will be as right as Jesus is right. And you will be fueled to do right as Jesus did right. You will be full and you will be happy. Last Tuesday evening, our family went to dinner at one of those all-you-can-eat pizza places. I think that Charlene and I decided on this in a conversation midday. So my stomach was thinking about this for much of the afternoon. And around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, my stomach began to speak concerning its desire to get on with the schedule of the day and get on to the pizza. We had decided that we would go a little bit earlier than we usually eat, but my appointments that afternoon ran later than I expected. And so it was rather late by the time I was able to get away. And as soon as I had opportunity, I got to a telephone and I called home and I said hello and I was asked, "Where are you?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm late, but look, I'm coming now, be waiting in the driveway." All right. So, I mean, I got home as fast as I legally could and we all got in the car and we drove over to this restaurant and parked as close as we could to the door. Went inside, and it's one of these deals where the pizzas, I mean, they're already cooked. You don't have to wait. And they're all lined up, ready to take. And then there's the counter where you're given a plate and a glass, and we pack. And we go into the counter, there's nobody there. And the guy's in the back, flipping pepperoni or whatever they do in the back. And we wait. I'll bet you we waited a minute. And he finally comes out, and I'm shoving money at this guy, and trying to get all this taken care of. And so I get my plate and this glass, and they're both empty. I went right over to the pizza deal, and I took a slice from the first pizza that was there, and I ate it. I mean, I just stood there and ate it. And then I filled the plate up. That made room for one more piece that otherwise I wouldn't have been able to have. And then I went over to the pop machine and took the glass, and I filled that up. I was thirsty. So I drank it. I just stood there and drank it and then filled up the glass again. So then I went to the table and polished off all the pizza that I had piled on there, as well as the Diet Coke that I had with it. And I went back, and altogether I ate, I'm not going to tell you, but I was full. They had to roll me out of there in order to get back to the car. And I was full, and I was satisfied. But, kind of interesting, just thinking about it, talking about it right now. Anybody have any Diet Coke or pizza? I wouldn't mind going back there and starting all over again. Oh, by the way, the name of the place was Godfather's. But let me tell you about a far, far better deal. You can go to God the Father, hungry and thirsty for righteousness, and He will fill you full. He will fill you with Jesus Christ, and you will be satisfied, and you will be happy, and you will want to go back again and again to be full to the brim. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for you will be filled.
Our bulletin indicates that Ivan Ludeman lives in Richfield. He also hunts wherever there's woodland, fishes wherever there's water, and serves Wooddale regularly where he's needed. Ivan, thank you for sharing with us this morning.
No editing there, Dave. How appropriate that last hymn, particularly that phrase, set our hearts on fire. The purpose of Wooddale Church is to honor God by bringing lives into harmony with Him and one another through fellowship, discipleship, evangelism, based on the Bible as our standard of truth. We live in significant times. People are hungry for the Word of God. Bible studies among the military forces in the Gulf War Theater are unprecedented in numbers and demand. Our brother-in-law, recently retired from the military chaplaincy of the Army, said that requests for chaplains in the Gulf Theater are so great that it's drained the numbers that we have in the military forces. Russia has discontinued teaching atheism in its colleges and universities, and the professors, many of them that taught those courses, are now unemployed. Printing presses in Russia that are able to print Bibles have such a great demand that they cannot meet the demands. Here at Wooddale Church, our worship attendance in 1984, when we moved to this site, has gone from an average of 1,200 per Sunday to now, in the last 1990, 2,300. During that same period of time, our Sunday school and Christian education adult congregations has gone from 1,000 average attendance in 1984 to now 1,600. Lives are being changed, and God is working in our midst. I'm here to focus your attention on our next capital fund drive. This will be the fourth capital fund drive for land and facilities on this site. Our theme is people expanding for God. That's each of us. Our goal is to raise a minimum of $2.5 million with a challenge goal of $2.7 million. The use of funds for this ministry expansion is threefold. Our highest priority is to expand opportunities for Christian education by completing the lower level of this worship center, which is 22,000 square feet, to finish and furnish it and some remodeling in the present Christian education facilities. The halls and lobby area are crowded on this level after our morning service. But if you really want to see crowded conditions, go to the halls and some of the facilities of the present Christian education facilities, particularly in the children's area. Some classrooms there that were designed for 25 and 30 now have 35 and 45, and without expansion, it's expected that they soon will have to accommodate up to 60 in some of those classrooms. The largest amount of funds in this fund drive is to expand our ministry by reduction of debt. You say, how can debt reduction expand our ministry? Debt reduction is the transfer of your financial resources that would be spent on interest for paying the loan to that of expanding our ministry to reach others for Christ. The third use of funds is to expand our ministry and outreach by starting new churches in the area. The means of major communication to our church family in accomplishing the three ministry expansion that I just talked about will be done through small group cluster meetings and home visitations. We trust that only a very few home visitations will need to be made for this purpose. We have a great steering committee that has been working since last August to bring this about. 18 cluster group meetings have been planned. Several of those were published in the January 29 issue of the Wooddale Witness. Each of you that attend Wooddale Church will be invited to attend a cluster meeting. Pastor Anderson will be speaking at each of those 18 cluster meetings. We have a slide presentation. Wooddalers will be giving their testimony about what Christ has done for them in their life here at Wooddale. And then there will be a challenge for you to commit some resources to this accomplishment of expansion of our ministry. If for some reason we miss an invitation to you, feel free to attend any of the cluster meetings. Cluster meetings are scheduled on Sunday morning during the Christian education hours and during the week. Please watch the mail for your invitation. If you're unable to make one of the cluster meetings as scheduled for you, then we will schedule another cluster meeting for you by calling you. And if you can't make one of those, we'll be happy to make an appointment with you to visit you in your home. I strongly encourage you to attend one of the cluster meetings. There we have the time to explain in depth the expansion of our goal, and you may have opportunity to ask questions. There will be a time for explaining in total effort the need. Often group meetings are better places of information because others ask questions that you may not think of about in your home. Also, there will be a slide presentation that we will not be able to take around from home to home. Then on Sunday evening, March 24, we'll have a great time of celebration together at the end of the fundraiser. It's exciting to work, to give, to pray, and to be fruitful in the Lord's ministry. We at Wooddale have been blessed to be in a ministry where God is changing the lives of people. Often I have the opportunity to sit in on interviews of those coming from membership at Wooddale Church. And it thrills me to hear what God is doing in the lives of people here through our ministry. I'm particularly grateful for what God has done in my own life while here at Wooddale Church. That's only been since 1959, however. I love you. God bless each of you as you pray about the future expansion of Wooddale and your part in it. Thank you kindly.